Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey folks, today's episode is a big double header for the Lincoln Project podcast, and it's kind of two sides of an interesting coin. We've got an interview first with Mary Claire Jelinek, who has given us a new book about the storming of the Capitol on January 6, 2021. It is an oral history, an inside oral history, talking to folks ranging from the people who stormed the building to the people who were inside fearing for their lives in elected office. It's a dark story, but it's enlightening in how the contemporaneous recollections of this terrible day are really burned into the history books with these interviews. Really brilliantly done. She's terrific in her coverage of Congress in general, but on this day, she really exceeds herself in every way. And Mary Claire Jelinek is the first. And the second interview is with Chris Matthews, who it was actually a little more optimistic because we're talking about his new book about Lessons from Bobby, about Bobby Kennedy, not the current one, the good one, and about how he combined a sort of ideological uplift with practical, like, in-your-face politics a little bit. It's fun. I've always loved Chris as an interviewer, and I was delighted to be able to interview him. So we have a fun episode today. Enjoy. See you soon.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey folks, it's Rick Wilson. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host as always. We're delighted that you're with us today. We're going to talk to Mary Claire Jelinek, who is a longtime Associated Press reporter who's got some of the most in-depth coverage of Congress for decades, who really understands the institution, understands where the players are, where their heads are at, where legislation is going. She's one of the people you turn to if you really want to know what happens on the Hill. I want to say this about her new book. And I want to say this because we're at the fifth anniversary of what I consider one of the darkest moments in our modern history. The book is Storm at the Capitol. It's an oral history of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And I have come to know and become friends with a lot of the people who faced this moment on that day. Folks like Mike Fanone and Harry Dunn and a whole bunch of other folks, more than I can even list, and members who've become friends as well. So, Mary Claire, I want to start out asking you, before we get into the meat of this book, how did the violence that day affect not only the cops who were on the front line, but the members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, who for a few hours that afternoon were locked in the chambers, locked in their offices, and feared for their lives?
Yeah, I think it was traumatizing for a lot of people, even if some of them don't always admit it. I think it was a pretty dramatic day for everyone. Certainly, that's not a normal thing for the, proceedings to, be suspended and everyone runs out of the chamber.
You were just 58 steps away from where the mob was amassing and where police were rushing to stop them. They were yelling. In this security video, you can see how the Capitol Police created a line and blocked the hallway with their bodies to prevent rioters at the end of the hall from reaching you and your staff.
Because of people, I was in the House chamber that day. There were people beating on the doors. They broke the glass, their guns drawn. And it was really dramatic. And I think it traumatized people probably more for the idea that it was just, you know, what it all meant, more than really thinking their lives were in danger, although a lot of people did think their lives were in danger, right, who were in different situations. But I think more the repercussions of it all is sort of, and, you know, things became very tense very quickly. It didn't really bring things, people together more. It's just sort of stoked more division. So, you know, I think it's something that we're all, you know, a lot of people, the country is still reckoning with in a lot of ways.
I talked to a Republican member not too long after it happened, who said, I feel awful because I can't say what I know to be true, that he caused this, that he sent these, really these people.
Yeah.
And it is a fascinating, that's to my mind, one of the fascinating questions is, there are a lot of members of his own party who have PTSD over this thing, who equally felt their lives were in danger on that day. So I want to loop back to the beginning here. You've written this book as an oral history, which I'm an absolute super fan of oral histories because I like hearing the contemporaneous recollections of people on major historical events. It is less framed. It is less poised and conscious. So talk to us about how you decided to write this as an oral history and tell us about some of the folks you talked to.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed like it made a lot of sense in really for two reasons. I mean, first of all, I mean, in a story that has had so many different narratives and that different people are sort of trying to, you know, present one set of facts in many different ways, it really seems like the most straightforward way to just get those, you know, I have more than 150 lawmakers, police, workers, journalists, you know, the writers themselves. And I think when you look at it, there really is sort of one basic, there's a lot of people interpret parts of it in different ways or, you know, the significance of it in different ways, but there really is one basic set of facts of what happened. And I think that, you know, it really bears out when you look at the way that the firsthand witnesses describe it. And, you know, also I just had a lot of material. I've been covering this since the day, you know, since the moments that it was happening. And I had a lot of material, you know, so we sort of say it in our notebooks. And I had a lot of really interesting stories and quotes, and I kind of wanted to be able to get those out there in some way, and that seemed like a good way to do it. There's also like so much testimony. You know, more than half the book around half of it is my own interviews, and a lot of it though is from court testimony, from congressional testimony, from FBI interviews, and things like that. And so there really was tons of that material that, you know, was sort of buried in court records, stories that police officers and the writers themselves who testified in their own trials. There was so much of that material, and it just seemed like a really good way to get more information out there, but also present just sort of a straightforward narrative.
What surprised you most in the writing of this? What fact or interview did you walk away from and say, wow, that puts a new perspective on what I saw and understood of that day?
I don't know about a new perspective, but the police officer interviews were really, really poignant in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And through my own interviews and also looking at what a lot of their testimony, a lot of them, like what surprised me was that so many of them thought they were going to die in the fighting.
Yeah.
And so many of them say that, like just outright, I thought this was it for me. I thought I was going to die. I thought I might not make it.
I was just a kid who had a dream of becoming a police officer and was lucky enough that it came true here with the Capitol Police. 5 years ago today, I was called a traitor, violently assaulted in the line of duty, punched in the face, pepper sprayed, and thought, I'm going to die here on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. My name is Winston Pajon, and I was an officer with the Capitol Police for over 5 years. I do not speak on behalf of all officers, nor the department, which I left 10 months later, but I believe my experience is not unique as one of many who showed up to work on January 6th like I did every day, ready to protect and serve the Congress, the congressional community, and the Capitol itself. Serving as an officer was the honor of my life, especially with the ceremonial unit honoring the inauguration of President Biden, as well as the lying in state ceremonies of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Officer Brian Sicknick, and Officer William Evans. I would be remiss to not mention honoring the life and service of Officer Howie Liebengood, who sadly took his own life just days after January 6th, 2021. On that day, I was assigned to the Civil Disturbance Unit, the Hard Gear Riot Team, on the West Front as thousands descended upon the Capitol from Pennsylvania Avenue. Before I knew it, we were completely overrun, and what started with mere insults turned into being brutally attacked. This should serve as no surprise to anyone. The evidence of violence is obvious and extensive. Hundreds of police officers, my friends, fought valiantly to defend the Capitol and our democratic process that day. From the West Front to inside the Capitol, the mob said to me, "President Trump sent us, and we don't want to hurt you, but we will."
Eventually, it was my turn in the meat grinder that was the front line. The terrorists had a wall of shields that they had stolen from officers, as well as stolen batons, what other armaments they brought. The two sides were at a stalemate at a metal doorframe that sat in the middle of the hallway. On my left was a man with a clear riot shield stolen during the assault. He slammed it against me and, with all the weight of the bodies pushing behind him, trapped me. My arms were pinned and effectively useless, trapped against either the shield on my left or the doorframe on my right. With my posture granting me no functional strength or freedom of movement, I was effectively defenseless and gradually sustaining injury from the increasing pressure of the mob. Directly in front of me, a man seized the opportunity of my vulnerability, grabbed the front of my gas mask, and used it to beat my head against the door. He switched to pulling it off my head, the straps stretching against my skull and straining my neck. He never uttered any words I recognized, but opted instead for guttural screams. I remember him foaming at the mouth. Eventually, he succeeded in stripping away my gas mask, and a new rush of exposure to CS and OC spray hit me. The mob of terrorists were coordinating their efforts now, shouting, "Heave! Ho!" as they synchronized, pushing their weight forward, crushing me further against the metal doorframe.
Just over and over again, you see police officers saying that. And that's, you know, these are, you know, really strong, really experienced people who have never felt that potentially in their job. Some of them said, "This is the first time I felt that way." And this sort of hand-to-hand combat that was going on outside of the Capitol.
Yeah.
And in some places inside the Capitol. It wasn't really what they're trained for. It's not really what a normal police officer is doing. You know, this sort of, you know, just it's like a medieval battle. Several
right.
people described it that way. And that's
sticks
not really
and stones.
What they're.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Just handmade weapons, you know, the fences, you know, whatever it might be, American flags. That's not really what they're trained for. It's like some one of the police officers I interviewed said he took a moment and looked out at the scene. And it looked to him like the Lord of the Rings, like one of those big, you know, probably CGI
set-piece
battles.
Medieval battles, right.
The movie, right. And, you know, that kind of made sense to me. I mean, I just, you know, they were just so overwhelmed and surprised. And a lot of them really knew, you know, talk about how they knew what the stakes were and what they were defending.
You know, it's the new year and people are feeling, I think, a little bogged down already by the impossible expectations they tend to set for themselves. When that new year rolls around, everybody has these sweeping goals that they're going to immediately change everything about their life. They're going to lose weight. They're going to work out. They're going to change the way they behave toward their friends or their family. All those things, they may be meritorious, but you know, that new year, new me stuff doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen instantaneously. Changes over time are what work. And slowing down and working through the things you need to change is what works. That's why growth therapy gives you just that, a place to slow down, to check in, to talk things through. You can start the year that way in a more grounded place. You know, folks shouldn't have to choose between paying their bills and getting mental health care, honestly. Growth therapy makes that care more affordable, more flexible, way easier to access, whether you need nights, weekends, or just a bit more breathing room. You know, if you've got insurance, you may already have therapy coverage and not even know it. Grow makes it easy to check, book, and start feeling better. Just ask the million plus people who've already found care with Grow Therapy. It's therapy that's insurance friendly, designed to fit your real life with no subscriptions. A lot of folks who've tried therapy, they worry about being able to find somebody, they worry about the scheduling, they worry about all those things. But finding a therapist in this day and age, with everyone's lives so busy, it should not seem like online dating with a deductible, right? Grow Therapy helps you find a therapist that works with you, and it's way easier, way faster, and way more affordable than you might expect. You know, one thing we've learned in this life is that anxiety doesn't clock out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Stress and grief don't keep a schedule. Depression doesn't care if it's your busy season. So Grow Therapy helps build a set of supports for you that help fit into your life, to fit into your schedule. Look, folks, working on your mental health doesn't happen all at once. It doesn't happen in a single flash of light. It happens in long, slow moments over time. It happens in one conversation at a time, one deep breath, one session. Grow Therapy makes it easier to start, easier to find and get help, easier to afford that help. And when you have somebody to talk to, when you have somebody that can listen to you work through those problems, that idea that the instantaneous change in the new year disappears, but that idea of real change, real improvement, real relief from the stresses that you're feeling over time, Grow Therapy can help you get there. Give them a try. Whatever challenge you are facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some for as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/Lincoln Project today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/Lincoln Project. growtherapy.com/Lincoln Project. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan. You know, you mentioned that in the book, and this is something that really struck me, because in my government career, I was back and forth to Congress in a five-year period, probably, I don't know, 300 or 400 times. For testimony, for, you know, dealing with you know, members of the Defense Department who were going to testify, handling their. And you said that you felt like there was a false sense of security about Congress before that day. And I thought about that because I was there when they put the mags in. And that was a big thing, like, oh my God, Congress is now an armed camp. They've got mags, which nobody thinks, you know, nobody blinks an eye at today. But it does seem like that false sense of security was also something that, as Americans, we had a sense of almost pride about it. Yeah, our national capital, anybody can walk in and see their member of Congress. And now it feels a lot different. Talk to me about that before and after on that sense of security about the Capitol.
Yeah, I think over and over, every single person that, you know, almost everyone who was there would say that they just never thought anything like that could happen. It seems so safe when you're in there. There's so many police everywhere. You know, it's a very protected building. And nothing like that's really happened before. I talked about a little bit in my introduction or in the book that, you know, I was there when in 2004, I think it was, when a plane was coming toward the Capitol and they evacuated all of us and we're like running out of the. Yeah. And you know, it was an all clear. It was obviously a false alarm, but it just seems so well organized. And I always have that in the back of my mind. Like, if something really bad happened, like, they've got it, you know, we're good. Like, we're going to be protected. And Jim Himes, him, who's a top Democrat, now the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, had a great quote about, like, you know, I always thought there's like some big red button and people come rappelling out of the ceiling of the House if there was something going on. I just think everyone always thought it was so protected, and we had no reason to think it wasn't. And, right. You know, there was a lot of security failures, but it was also just such an unexpected thing to happen that many people.
Yeah. That strikes me as part of it that the, you know, and over the years, there's always been the occasional crazy who walks in, you know, who is mentally ill, who wants to, you know, show the congressman their conspiracy books or whatever they've got. And a few times people have brought a gun. There've been, you know, it's not completely without the pathologies of America, but this was at a scale, and that scale, I think, is one of the things that makes it so different mentally for those folks who it looked like there was an unlimited number of people coming down the mall. Somebody said that to me, that it looked like an unlimited number of rioters could keep coming and keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. So that day. That Trump motivating the mob to go down there in part was coming from Mike Pence, who was not sending, quote unquote, the right signal that he was going to help block certification. Talk to us about what you learned about some of the politics that were going on, some of the questions both in the House and how to stop Pence if he did it, and in the Senate about that. What I still think is sort of the key catalyst for Trump's walking out. He was pissed off when he walked out there to the podium at the Oval because he knew that Pence was not going to back his play.
That's right. And they had talked that morning as mm-hmm. well. That was something that I was really interested in immediately afterward. And I actually wrote a story for the first anniversary, and some of the reporting from that went into the book, just talking about how there were some of the Democrats, Jamie Raskin, Nancy right. Pelosi, sort of early on in the year were thinking this, you know, just they just wanted to be prepared for, because Trump was talking about how he, you know, it was rigged if Democrats won the presidential election. I think they started thinking like, well, what are we going to do if that happens, if he does try to say it was rigged? So they were sort of looking at this January 6th date, which is the traditional date that the election is always certified. And so, but especially after Biden won, was declared the winner, and Trump was really, you know, filing all the lawsuits, all of which were dismissed or rejected. They really started, they kind of created a little group of people who were trying to figure out what they would do if Pence did stand up and try to reject the votes in some way. And they had all sorts of scenarios. But one thing they sort of said over and over is that we weren't really sure that we would be able to stop it because it's such an unusual thing. It's not in the Constitution. What do you do if this happens? Because it was an unprecedented thing to happen. And they have updated the Electoral Count Act to clarify that the vice president doesn't have that role now. But, there was all sorts of different, you know, strategizing going on. And, there were Republicans. Liz Cheney was talking to I talked to her and I talked to the parliamentarian, and they were talking about, they were discussing too, what would happen. And she said that, you know, she was driving home a couple of days before and she felt physically sick because she wasn't sure what was going to happen and what Pence was going to do. So I think that's something that people don't totally remember, is that nobody knew what Pence was going to do. There's, you know, everyone knows now what he did, but it wasn't until 1 o'clock that afternoon, which is when the session started, that he distributed a letter and said what he was going to do, that he wasn't going to follow Trump's wishes and try to block or obstruct any of the electoral votes. But it was really tense. Like, no one knew what was going to happen. And, you know, that was one of the reasons I wanted to be there, too, is because we knew it was going to be a really interesting day. We had no, it was COVID. So, we were all sort of different, people were going in on different days. But I really wanted to be there because I knew it was going to be a really interesting day. I obviously had no idea how interesting.
I weirdly have to take partial responsibility for January 6th because we ran an ad on the 3rd, targeted the White House, that said, Mike Pence shouldn't do this. Donald Trump, you're wrong. Mike Pence is going to follow the law. And, you know, we were trying to both rattle Trump a little bit, but also to tell Pence that we understood that we were watching, that the world was watching. And in a bunch of other books, it's come out like Trump was so angry about the ad, he wanted Pence to say in advance, I'm going to do your bidding. And I feel guilty. I tell people this all the time. I'm like, I'm surprised. I almost got Mike Pence killed, which I feel terrible about. But on the other hand, you know, he did the right thing in the end. When Pence was hiding in that garage with his detail, that had to be a moment of just absolute, you know, but terror, because that mob was very much mediated by social media or motivated by social media. They knew Trump was angry at Pence that day. That tweet about Mike Pence, you know, extreme measures or whatever it was, got hundreds of thousands of views within a few minutes. Did Pence sense that moment as his life being in immediate danger?
Well, Pence has his own book that he detailed some of this, and I used some of his aides who were who testified before the January 6th committee. I was not able to interview them for the book. I tried, but that was one case where some of the public documents were really helpful, and they did a long interviews with both Greg Jacob and Mark Short, which I used.
I know Mark,
And a little bit of I used a couple lines from hence his book. I tried not to do too much of that. But yeah, they all really sort of outline that. And the main thing that they detail is just how strongly he felt that he should not be seen fleeing the Capitol in a limousine. And, you know, he talks about how he, you know, sort of put his finger in their face and said, "I'm not going in that limousine." And when he walked into the garage, they were like, "Well, why don't you just get in and we can just sit here?" And he knew that, you know, he was like, "I'm not doing that. I'm not getting in." And he said that was the car was already moving when he, you know, got into the garage. So they were really ready to get him out. And I would imagine if anyone was the Secret Service agent in charge, they would have wanted to get him out. But he felt, you know, and congressional leaders had been evacuated. They were not there. But he stayed in that garage and, you know, was safe, obviously. But I really think that the overwhelming feeling that they all had was just, you know, just sort of this duty that they had to stay and they weren't going to be knocked out. You know, they weren't going to be pushed out of the Capitol.
Right. So you've interviewed some of the folks who were on the delivering end of this moment of fear and terror and violence. What was your big takeaway from talking to the folks who were in the crowd, who were part of the attack?
My main takeaway was that there is such a diversity of motivations in that crowd. You know, we know about the extremist groups that were, you know, coming, you know, planning for potential violence, seemed to really have like a plan to go in and to how to access the building, you know, and really knew what they were doing. There were also a lot of people who just got caught up in the moment and, you know, went down after they heard Trump or what, for whatever reason. There were other people who just kind of thought it was fun. I interviewed one writer, Jason Riddle, who was really interesting, and he actually tried to reject his pardon earlier this year. And he told the story of going in, and he ended up in the Senate parliamentarian's office where people were ransacking it, and he took a bottle of wine and stole a book, and he came out, and he said he thought it was like euphoria. It was like this party to him. It was fun. He said he asked someone where the bathroom was. You know, he was just kind of hanging out and having a great time. And he said he didn't even really believe the lie. He just, you know, went to Trump rallies all the time. And, you know, he sort of saw it as his life. And he went out and he talked to this man who actually who bought the book off and that he'd stolen, and said that he'd seen someone being carried out bleeding, you know, who'd been shot. And I assume that that was Ashley Babbitt, who was shot trying to get into the house. And he told me like his whole life changed in that moment. He realized what he was doing was wrong and that he could be in a lot of trouble. And he said he just ran, like he found and he like hugged a wall and like just got out of there. And, you know, now he's talked about that a lot since. And I thought that was just like really interesting to hear what he was thinking in the moment and how different, you know, different experiences were and also the reaction since, right? Like some people regret it. Some people don't. Some people really think it was justified. And, you know, it wasn't one type of person there, but, you know, they did become one big mob, you know, that was sort of that mob mentality took over.
What do you think would have happened if they had found Nancy Pelosi or Mitt Romney or Adam Schiff or any notable name? What do you think would have happened with those folks?
Yeah, I don't know. And that's a terrifying thing to think about. You know, there's a quote in the book from Stephanie Murphy who said, I think it's important. Mm-hmm. Stephanie Murphy, who was a congresswoman at the time, and said, you know, I think people need to remember that the reason they didn't hurt any members of Congress is they didn't encounter any members of Congress, at least not face to face, and or at least like up close where they could have hurt them. And so, you know, we don't know that, but I mean, a lot of people speculate on it. And a police officer I interviewed, he said, I was there, I fought those people, and I can say with confidence that they were there to hurt our members of Congress. But another thing that a lot of people said was that it didn't have to be Adam Schiff or, you know, it didn't have to be Mitt Romney. I mean, several people pointed out and made the valid point that these rioters didn't necessarily know every member of Congress. They weren't necessarily going to do a sorting, I think one member said, which is like, you know, they're not going to say, wait, are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? You know, they could have hurt all of them, you know? And so we don't know what they would have done and if other people would have stepped in or if, you know, but, you know, luckily we didn't have to find out.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great, outcomes of that day. Although it again, it's the worst counterfactual. What would have happened if makes my stomach hurt sometimes, because you just think about, you know, these people were motivated by something that wasn't real. They've also sort of come to this, even though, as you point out, they're correctly point out, there were a bunch of different mobs that day. There were the 3% or Oath Keeper type guys who were more professional in their objectives. They wanted to get in and cause whatever trouble with the certification. And those two young aides who took the certification documents out of the office, bravest two women of the day in a lot of ways, right? But that the bulk of them that went into that building, as you said, they didn't really realize it what was happening in the beginning, but all of them had come out of sort of a fever swamp of Donald Trump versus Congress, Republican or Democrat. He is, you know, a different category of human than members of Congress. So that again, it's counterfactual. What would have happened if, I mean, I think we know, you know, I don't think Ashley Babbitt was going to stop when she came through that window, if she'd come through and gotten to Nancy Pelosi. And that's an interesting case too, because they've really tried to make Ashley Babbitt into kind of a secular saint, but you know, she was a QAnoner who believed in a lot of QAnon things. How big did the QAnon impact appear in these interviews with the rioters?
I mean, a lot of people talk about it. There was another one. This wasn't an interview that I did, but I used a FBI interview for an Iowa man named Doug Jensen, who had a really interesting long. He went home to Iowa and then went voluntarily to the FBI and then and really talked to them. And he talked a lot about QAnon. And it was interesting. You know, he'd really sort of found it by just spending time on his phone at night after his construction job.
Sure.
And it really took hold, and he started traveling around and watching Trump speak. And he's the one who was chasing Officer Eugene Goodman up the stairs in the Senate side with a big Q on his shirt.
Yeah.
And he was sort of waiting for, you know, someone to say something, that, you know, from the Qs that I guess the what Q was supposed to say,
the
right?
Code yeah. language of QAnon,
and
right.
you know, he thought he heard it, and that sent him to Washington. So it does seem like, you know, I don't think everyone was espousing that theory, but definitely a lot of them were and talk about it, and certainly Ashley yeah. Babbitt was as well. And that actually is sort of where the title of the book comes from. And there's a quote in the front that the storm is coming. She put that on Twitter a couple days before. And, mm-hmm. you know, obviously it
dark to come, light, dark to was, light.
It was just
weeks,
sort of this
right.
Q theory that, you know, Trump was, there was going to be this final battle against Trump's, you know, biggest political enemies.
And the global pedophile cabal, unlike Jeffrey Epstein, which anyway. Hey, folks, new year and new devices. A lot of us have new phones, new laptops, new tablets during this new year. You know, whether you're upgrading your tech or sticking with what you've got, it's time to protect all of your and your family's devices for 60% off with Webroot's trusted cybersecurity solutions. This year, choose the protection that's right for you. Visit webroot.com/Lincoln Project for 60% off. In a new year with new devices, you need to protect your identity, your data, and your privacy. And you can do that with Webroot. For 60% off right now. The Webroot Total Protection Plan, it's an all-in-one product. It's got plan options for individuals, if it's just you, for up to 5 devices, or for families with up to 10 people in your family and up to 10 devices. It's real-time antivirus protection against the emerging threats, malware, ransomware, all these phishing scams you see out there these days. It's also got a firewall and a network monitor that just doesn't quit. Web Threat Shield detects and blocks malicious websites before you even visit them. That takes out one of those strategies that the bad guys are using to get you to click somewhere where they can steal your identity. It works with Edge and Chrome and Firefox, all the big browsers. It's got a password manager, so it can protect your logins and your passwords. And it's also got a system optimizer that can go in and detect and find traces of stuff you don't want on your computer that the bad guys might be putting out there. The family protection is terrific because it includes everything from the young kids who have their first tablet to students to seniors. If you have one leak in your data protection, it all could be compromised. So it's great that Webroot can cover an entire family. It's also got advanced dark web monitoring. They also look through credit and financial monitoring databases to make sure that you get a quick alert if someone does have your information out there. identity monitoring with identity health status updates. And you know what? One of the other aspects of Webroot that I love is they've got a great VPN system. And the VPN can be for 5 devices or 10 devices. And they've got up to 80 locations in 65 countries. It hides your IP address, helps protect your personal data, and protects your location from hackers. And they've got a backup and restore with unlimited cloud storage for either a PC or a Mac. There's also the Webroot Essentials plan. It's got protection for 1, 3, or 5 devices. The same kind of real-time antivirus protection against all those threats we talked about. Really lightning-fast scans. The Web Threat Shield also detects those malicious websites. And again, it works with all the big browsers, Edge, Chrome, Firefox. And it's got a system optimizer to go in to your system and make sure it deletes traces of any malicious activity. You know, customers absolutely love Webroot. They've been protecting folks for 25 years. They got a 90% retention rate. It's lightning fast. It's lightweight. It's 6 times faster in the scan than its competitors and uses 33 times less space. I don't know what the other guys are doing, but Webroot has got this tight code base that really doesn't take up a lot of your hard drive. No annoying pop-ups. And it's up to you who you protect. You can select multi-device and multi-identity plans. You can choose to share that protection with your family members and friends. And one more thing about Webroot that I think folks really find valuable. It's got 24/7 US-based customer support for identity theft restoration. So this new year, choose the protection that's right for you. Visit webroot.com/Lincoln Project and get 60% off. That's webroot.com/Lincoln Project for 60% off. So when the pardons hit, very few people seem to have rejected their pardons. I know Pam Hemphill, the MAGA granny, you mentioned the other gentleman. I don't know how many people said, no, I've learned my lesson. I think they almost all took the pardons. What kind of message do you think that sends in terms of consequence?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, in our job, like at the Hill Reporter, there were certainly a lot of members, Republican members, close Trump allies who were saying in the days before that they didn't think the most violent rioters should be pardoned. And that does seem to still be, you know, something that it's hard for a lot of people to defend that, you know, especially the most violent people who had, you know, hurt these police officers. And we saw in a hearing, I think it was a couple of months ago, in Officer Daniel Hodges, who has spoken out a lot and is also in the book, was testifying as a Democratic witness at a hearing in the Senate. Peter Welch, a Vermont Democratic senator, asked how many of the other witnesses who were Republican witnesses thought that that they should have been pardoned, even the ones that had heard Hodges, who was sitting right, you know, next to them, right. And they all raised their hands. So, I mean, it does seem like there really is still a lot of support, but, you know, questions about the most violent of those rioters. But, you know, that whatever people think, it's been done, and, you know, there's not really
hard to unring the bell.
Not much that can be done. But I think that there is a really variety of responses from the rioters, of people who expressed some contrition, but maybe went back on that, or were not, you know, were sort of defiant at first, and then eventually kind of came around and said they don't think what they did was right. So it really is, you know, there's a lot of different reactions out there.
Yeah. So the pardons are one part of the revisionism here, but there has been a massive amount of historical revisionism that this administration has tried to push out. That Nancy Pelosi was to blame, that the FBI, it was a false flag, the FBI ran the operation, all that. Talk to us a little bit about how that revisionism has just crept into the public narrative about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we sort of saw it for the first time in the day after January 6th, there was just universal condemnation. Everyone was, denounced the violence, you know, certainly acknowledged there was violence. There wasn't really anyone trying to say there wasn't. Although some people blamed Trump and some people didn't. But really in the months after, we started to see the sort of defense of the rioters, question, Andrew Clyde sort of famously talked about how if you watch one video, it looks like a normal tourist visit. But that sort of crept into, sort of broader narratives that I think in some ways culminated in this white paper, or whatever you call it, that whatever the White House put on their website on this fifth anniversary, that I actually found pretty interesting, because it was like laying out a lot of these narratives all as one narrative, which I, you know, they were sort of saying they have a whole, you know, they're saying that the, you know, that people marched peacefully to the Capitol and then were basically attacked by the police, which I think we know through, you know, certainly all the interviews in my book and everywhere else.
10,000 hours of video.
That's what I was about to say. Extensive video archive. That is not how things happened. So, you know, it has evolved for sure.
So Nancy Pelosi is sort of the you know, archetypical bad guy for Republicans and for Trump. The idea that Pelosi deliberately let this happen or deliberately caused this to happen. When you interviewed the speaker, what was her reaction to that stuff?
Well, I think she obviously really vehemently pushes back on that. I think her line repeatedly has been, "No, I did not plan my own assassination attempt." I think that, right. you know, if you read the book, but also like look at a lot of the video, there people were hunting for Pelosi,
yes,
in the building. They were calling out for
Nancy,
her.
Come out and play. All
yeah,
that stuff.
Exactly.
Right.
They ransacked her office. Uh-huh. I have a narrative in the book from two Pelosi staffers who were hiding behind a door as they ransacked the office and were calling out for her and were calling out for them. And, you know, one of them describes it as like maniacal whooping, you know, of where's Nancy, where mm-hmm. are you, you know? And I think that there were definitely, you know, that is certainly one, you know, point that people forget sometimes, is they were calling out for her as they went through the building.
Really a terrifying moment, I'm sure. So let me ask you the one final question, wrapping this up. This fundamentally changed the way it feels for an American citizen to visit Congress, to go to that building. It changed it for the members. It changed it for the staff, for the security, and for citizens who want to go to the Capitol of their country, the seat of our democracy. What can restore that sense that this is not a place of danger and risk and fear and terror in your mind?
My gosh, I don't know what can restore it. You know, we see a lot of divisions on the Hill that they're yeah. still there. But one thing I sort of think when I'm there is it is an open building, right? It is like, you know, you can't break through windows and doors, but it is open to everyone. And it always will be like that. And I think that won't ever change. Even though, you know, during COVID, they and right afterward,
sure.
there are these huge fences around the building, but those came down within a few months. And it always will be a building that people can come in and respect. And it's, you know, it's just such a beautiful building. I still like look up at the top of the rotunda every time I'm in there. You know, and I think that, you know, I think that you can't think like that it isn't, you know, it is a place of fear or whatever. You have to just sort of keep going. I'm not sure what they can do to try to, you know, patch over these tensions that still exist. But yeah. I do think it's still a building that people should come visit. And, you know, they have improved security a lot the last 5 years. They've been working on that really hard. So, you know, hopefully nothing like this will ever happen again.
Let's hope not. Folks, this is an amazing, amazing history of a very dark day. Mary Claire Jelinek, thank you so much for coming on the show. Folks, the book is Storm at the Capitol. Do give it a read. I read through it this weekend. It's enlightening, and it is an oral history. So you're really hearing contemporaneous recollections of these things. And it is something that I think you almost have a duty as a citizen to read this, because it is about an inflection point in our country and our culture that has reshaped a lot of our politics and a lot of our idea about how we interact with the Congress that represents us all. Thanks for listening
to
the Lincoln
so
Project Podcast. And Mary Claire Jelinek, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you so much.
Pro Savings Days are on at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, my Lowe's Pro Rewards members get an additional 5% off when you buy 5 or more select GE, Whirlpool, and Electrolux kitchen or laundry major appliances. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 123. Discount valid to Milo's Pro Rewards members only. Exclusions and other restrictions apply. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for details. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
We're delighted to be joined today by our friend Chris Matthews. Chris is one of the great chroniclers of American politics in our generation, one of the great analytical minds, wrote the seminal book about modern politics called Hardball years ago. And he has a new book out that I have absolutely just enjoyed the hell out of, and it's called Lessons from Bobby. It is about 10 big lessons taken from the life and leadership of Robert F. Kennedy Sr. Not the one in office today, but his the good Bobby, if you will. And these 10 lessons, Chris, I absolutely love how you broke it out, because it captured the combination of what my reading of history always was with RFK, which was he combined that ideology and that uplift with an understanding of power and politics at a level that played through in this 1960 campaign, that was playing through in the campaign that he was in before he was tragically assassinated. So talk to us about how you came to write the book and how you came to pick these lessons.
Well, it was a combination of me and Stu Roberts, an editor at the Simon & Schuster. In the middle of the summer, when I was doing all other kinds of other things and had all kinds of other commitments, he called me up and said, I want you to do a book on Bobby Kennedy. I want it ready for November. It will be published in November. That gives you a couple weeks. Write it. And so I had done a lot of work on the Kennedys over the years. The Kennedy and Nixon book was a favorite of mine because it was so complicated about their relationship and how friendly they were for so many years, Nixon and Kennedy. And we never knew any about that. And of course, I did the book on Jack and the book on Bobby, and both had gotten big sales. So I went back into my inventory of brain and trying to figure out what I knew. And we came across this idea of rules that that Bobby had certain standards that he met that people today, including especially Donald Trump, don't meet. So it'd be good to remind people of what he stood for. And it was basic things like, well, the one that jumps out at you is concede when you lose an election. It's so basic to our system, right, which is that if you're going into politics, you must accept the fact in your heart that you may have to walk up to that TV camera on election night. In a 50-50 world, might have to admit that you blew it, that you took all the money people gave you, all the work they'd done, right, for you, all the volunteer effort, and the zeal of people, and you blew it. You just came up short. They have to do that. And now Donald Trump has never accepted that reality, that politics is a 50-50 game. You win a couple, he won two, he lost one. For the presidency, he would never face up to that.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop.
Bobby did that very dramatically in Oregon. A week before he was assassinated, Bobby lost the Oregon Democratic primary, and he lost it for some good reasons, that he knew there were some good reasons. He had gotten into the race for president as an anti-Vietnam War guy the day before St. Patrick's Day, which is the 16th of March. Let's say the other guy from Minnesota had gotten into the race in November of the previous year. He had been in the race for months. He went out there with Howard Lowenstein raising the Dump Johnson movement. He went out there and McCarthy, Gene McCarthy was a hero of mine, would go out there and campaign whenever no one else was doing it. But Bobby did it finally. And he knew he lost all the A students. you know, Roger might have, CBS would say, you lost all the A students. Wouldn't that bother you? He said, right. Of course it bothers me. The guys at the Boston Globe knew that. It drove them crazy that the best students, the smartest, most gung-ho, most passionate, if you will, were all the anti-war kids. We're all working for McCarthy. And in Oregon, where there were, it's mainly a suburban state, it's not a big ghetto kind of state, if you will. And he knew that he couldn't appeal to poor people. He said, I do better with poor people. What a great line. He said, I do better with poor people, you know, who had it rough. So he election night, he walked up to the camera and on camera admitted he'd lost and did it so well that Patrick Buchanan, who was in the audience looking at scouting things out for Richard Nixon, said he was never so impressed with the guy. He said, I'd never seen him before, and he was thrilled at how great he looked. Now, maybe some of this is the Irish, and I know about that. Maybe that's just rooting for the guy, the Irish guy on the other side. But I think it was really a dramatic look at Bobby, that Bobby knew how to show hurt in his face and admit defeat in his face. And he said, basically, if I didn't think McCarthy was a serious candidate until now, well, I was wrong. He's a serious candidate, or I'm not even a candidate. This guy's a real candidate. I'm going to debate him. If I lose in California next week, I will quit the campaign. He laid everything on the line. He really did what Adlai Stevenson did when he lost to General Eisenhower in 1952. You know, he just laid it out there and said, I lost the big one, but I'm coming back next week. And he did. And he campaigned in a way that was frightening with blacks and Hispanics. Going into tough neighborhoods with people ripping his shoes off, not just his tight slip and his cufflinks, his shoes off were taken from the guy. He was so intimately involved in campaigning. But he said, if I don't do that, people don't really trust you. He said, they hear your speeches, but if you don't really let them touch you, really physically embrace you, they don't trust you. And that's what it took for him to beat McCarthy in a very close race, it turned out, in California, a few minutes before he was shot and killed. It's an amazing story. Yeah, I mean, the guy was a hero. The nerve it took to take it on the gangsters in the Rackets Committee is in the Clown Committee was just unbelievable.
Almost every place that I've been so far, and I haven't received an assessment here in Texas yet, but every place up until now, the report has been since the passage of the legislation that big-time gambling by the big-time operators has been materially decreased since the passage of the legislation. Also, the coordinated drive that has been conducted by the various investigative agencies of the federal government has had its effect. And in fact, the head of the Royal Mounted Police in Canada said in a speech last week that Canada will now have to pass legislation and take new steps because many of the big-time gangsters and hoodlums of the United States are now moving to Canada because of the drive that is being made against them here in this country.
These guys, Joey the Torch and people like that, they're frightening characters. They're right out of On the Waterfront, not The Godfather. On the Waterfront, they were really rough.
Right.
Johnny Friendly, remember him? And
yeah.
And he did all that. And with his brother, he had to go to his brother and say, you got to drop this guy, Sinatra. This is killing you. You got to stop hanging out. He's mobbed up, this guy. And whatever he knew about him being mobbed up, he said, he's dangerous. You can't hang out. You can't go to his weekend in Palm Springs. You got to go with Bing Crosby instead of Republican guy. But he, then he knew how to talk to his brother.
New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. So now get two snack wraps plus fries and a medium soft drink for just $8.
For limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
He also told me, you got to stop hanging out with this girlfriend of yours. You know, that, he hated talking about that with Jack Kennedy, but he had to say, you can't go out with her anymore. Right. She's mobbed up. She's with, you know, she's got a gangster for a boyfriend. You can't do this.
The Giaconas or whatever it was. Yeah.
And I think during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he showed it. He made his bones. I mean, nobody's ever figured out the whole thing. You cannot attack Cuba. There's X many thousand Russians there. If we kill all those Russians, they're going to move on Berlin, and we won't have a nuclear war on our hands. He understood consequences. He was cool enough to think about, if you do this, think about what else is going to happen. When Trump went into Venezuela, I kept thinking, well, what are the Chinese going to pull? Well, they can pull whatever they want, and they haven't done it yet. The Russians could do all kinds of stuff.
And you're absolutely right. That they get a vote, you know? And RFK recognized during the Cuban Missile Crisis that this wasn't just, we weren't going to walk away with just a single clean America number one victory. It was going to be messy and complicated.
Sneaky.
But
sneaky.
The alternative.
Sneaky. Yeah, anyway, that was right, the sneakiest thing in the book. He said, okay, we'll pull the missiles out of Turkey. Apparently also,
out of
turns
Turkey.
Out when I'm studying this, also out of southern Italy. And we did that in the dead of night, and nobody knew about it. Not Brits. The Prime Minister of Britain didn't know about it.
Nope.
Nobody knew that we were giving them a little Khrushchev, and Khrushchev still didn't survive. He still went down because they thought he was weak. He was weak.
Right.
They were weak politically
and strategically. Yeah, I mean, but that idea of seeking peace is one of your principles here. He was trying to. Stop Vietnam. He was trying. He provably, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the resolution of it was one of the great peace actions of any president in a long time.
And I think it led to the limited. Rick, and it also led to the limited nuclear test ban treaty, which we wouldn't test
ban
nuclear
treaty.
Technology above the ground because you could really test it.
Yep.
You can chronicle it. But it also was leading to something with Khrushchev. There was something going on. Khrushchev allowed Kennedy's speech to play in Russia, in the Soviet Union. That's an amazing, mm-hmm. dramatic thing, to let an American speech be played over there.
Sure.
I think he was trying, they were trying in their own way. They said, okay, we've been to the abyss. We've been right to the edge of horror beyond any imagination. And let's learn from it. And it's amazing how a secular country, like the Soviet Union, the enemy, was able to find a common ground of, you know, as Jack Kennedy said, we all live on the same planet. You know, it's a very much a speech like his father gave when his father was defending the dictatorships before World War II. Remember, go back and look at Joe Kennedy's speech about we all live on the same planet. And it was sort of defending like, okay, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. But in this case, the bad is really the destruction of the world. Let's face that together.
It strikes me as a moment, and I was born 24 hours to the day before JFK was shot. A couple of days before that, in Tampa, my mom was hosting a Young Democrats reception for JFK. So I came in I came in unconsciously of the whole story, but that arc of history between Jack and Bobby's assassination kicked off this very long stretch in America of chaos and despair, and I wonder what the, and it's a counterfactual. I wonder what you think would have happened if RFK had not, if Sirhan Sirhan had not been in that ballroom that day.
Well, there's so many.
If he had survived and won that race.
First of all, I was at Holy Cross at college after Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And I was checking my mail like we do we all did that in the mail room after lunch. And a guy came up to me and said, I'll bet you $5 Kennedy was just shot. Now, this guy was an exploitive personality, to say the least.
Jesus.
So I went over to my classroom to a world history class, and the professor said, you can leave, you don't have to stay. And I went over and watched Cronkite for 24 hours.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. This picture has just been transmitted by wire. It is a picture taken just a moment or two before the incident. If you can zoom in with that camera, we can get a closer look at this picture. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Ed Moynihan once said to me, we've never gotten over it. You've never gotten over it, according to me. And that's true.
Right.
9/11 was a big deal. The people lived in Manhattan, but I got to tell you, Kennedy assassination resounds. The before and after of that event, the imagined world before that, with Jackie looking like $1 million and him riding along in that car with Connolly and his wife, Nellie, and that world disappeared with those shots.
Yep.
It just did. And then it was so grim up there in Worcester, Massachusetts, that the Beatles came on in early 64. You were too young to catch this, but the Beatles coming to America
and going
on Ed Sullivan that night was like an upbeat that we nearly, it may have been artificial in the entertainment world, but we all thought, my God, this is positive. We're happy. The Beatles make us happy. But the grimness in the country was only really truly relieved when McCarthy came out in the fall of 67, and I went to March on the Pentagon and all that stuff, and Norman Mailer, and that sort of anti-war thing helped a little. But when Gene McCarthy came out and said, I'm running for president against Lyndon Johnson, I'm going to end this war, that was unbelievable. But you're right, that period between 63 and 68 was brutal. And then Bobby and Gene McCarthy, these two anti-war guys, both liberals, I suppose you could say, you know, McCarthy more than Kennedy was more of a liberal, more of a Stevenson kind of guy. You got the sense that there was really optimistic that maybe if Bobby had gotten past California, which he did, he won it by about 8 points. If he gotten past New York the following week, which would not have been easy. New York was heavy with Stevenson people, and Gene McCarthy was a primary top Stevenson guy. So he had gotten past New York. He would have gotten then to Richard Daley in Chicago and some of the big bosses, Bill Green in Philadelphia, people like that. He would have gotten a bit young Bill. He would have been able to get the big city people. So he would have stormed into that convention in Chicago. And I tell you, that convention would have been so different. Instead of some evil people claiming to be students throwing razor blades in their turds at the police and citing the terrible police already. It would have been wait a minute, this looks like it. Bobby might pull this off. It would have been so inspiring. And I don't know how it would have worked. It may have been the old farts and the Humphrey people, who I've never understood, by the way, people my age who liked Hubert Humphrey. I mean, I liked Hubert Humphrey in many ways, but to defend him in the war situation was impossible to understand. But the idea of Bobby going to that convention and taking on the bosses, it would have been so great. And I don't know how it would have turned out, but it would have been so much better than Humphrey and Muskie. Well, I love Muskie, but that didn't matter. It wasn't a happy event, and nor was the general election with Nixon. Was a very impressive election by Humphrey standards, very professional by Nixon's, we ended up with the wrong president. We just did.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Well, I mean, that counterfactual, if we had had RFK as president in January of 69, the different path the world would have taken, not only concerning Vietnam, but so much other stuff that he cared about, you know, and then we wouldn't have had that Nixonian moment where it's like, you know, where the seed was planted. If the president says it's legal, it's legal. You know, all that long arc of things that kept reducing the faith of Americans and institutions. I don't know if it would have stopped, but I think there's an argument that it would have, that he would have helped, you know, restore. It wouldn't have been Camelot Part Two, but he would have helped restore, I think, a sense of honor, I guess, or strength, I guess. And that's a lot of the stuff you outline here, like, you know, uphold the law, enforce the law.
And one of the things about law, let me just talk about law and order today. You have the people in Minneapolis, the good people. A lot of them are good people. In fact, most of them are. They're out there because they, let's face it, they don't like the deportations. In general, they probably don't like the whole immigration policy of the administration, which was basically, if you look at the voting, basically was voted for in gross terms. The immigration policy of this administration has been very effective politically at the border. People accept the fact that we had an open border, that Biden wasn't taking it seriously at all, and they've stopped people crossing the border with impunity. People from China and all over the world just finding their way to the southern border and getting into the country. They like that part. They like the idea of and emptying the prisons. If there are people that committed crimes since they arrived in this country, of course, they're the first to go. But the idea of pinpointing to Portland and Minneapolis, and I guess they've been hoping to get San Francisco thrown in there and Chicago. Trump wanted to hit all the blue cities. He wanted to hit any city that even smacked of sanctuary, anything that looked like they were harboring people in the country illegally. And that's where he's picked his fights. And he's picked his fights with the middle class because a lot of middle class people, as I said, tolerate a general illegal immigrant policy. But the grabbing of people in the streets and taking people from the pew next to you in church and taking them out of the country after they've been here and paying taxes and Social Security, even though they're not going to get Social Security, and not voting and all the other privileges of being an American, throwing them out is not very tasteful to people. They go, wait a minute, this is not what we should be doing. So people like Ms. Good are among those people. She was among those people that didn't like what was going on. And for that, she's been called a terrorist, basically being ridiculed in her death by her and by Kristi Noem and all these other creature features for the Trump administration. Homan has been okay. Homan said, let's look and see how it works it out. Let's look at the law. Let the law take it. Give it a couple months.
I wasn't on the scene. I'm not an officer that may have body cam video. It'd be unprofessional to comment on what I think happened in that situation. Let the investigation play out and hold people accountable based on the investigation.
I did not initially have Tom Homan as the voice of moderation in ICE, but he compared to Noem and compared to that weird guy Bovino they put on the ground, you know, he may take money in a kava bag, but I was surprised he's been less publicly insane lately than Noem.
I'll tell you, when you put that cowboy hat on, he looked like a character out of Yellowstone, which I Nixie, like anybody else, I love Yellowstone. I understand what you're looking for.
Of course.
But the imagery there of a cowgirl with a hat on is a statement of, I'm cool. This isn't cool. What's going on here is not cool. It's not good. It's not American. It's not cowboy. It's rough. And you killed someone. And you killed somebody with point blank gun. A guy pointing a gun at a head.
Yeah.
At a person's head. Mm-hmm. And shooting three or four times.
Right. He's no longer in danger. He is the danger.
How many times are you going to shoot into that head? I mean, it's unbelievable that you can actually have the trigger finger mentality to even do it. How much hatred did you have?
Yeah.
I mean, this guy had a lot of hatred stored up. And,
when you look at her last words were, I'm not even mad at you, and his last words were, you fucking bitch. It tells you everything.
That was post-mortem.
Yeah, that's right. He had killed her and said, "Oh, fucking bitch."
So how did he get the idea?
That there's something broken in that man's soul.
She was worthy of that kind of language. He must have had an attitude about. Was that about what who dragged him for 6 months ago? What was he mad at?
He had bashed in the back window of a car a few months before that, trying to get somebody out of the car, and gotten dragged down the street, and in that case. His supervisor should have said, hey, dude, take some time off, get some PTSD counseling. You know, let's not put you back out there if this is going to be something that you're this affected by.
It's like the guy in Stripes. If you touch my stuff, I'll kill you. Remember that?
Francis.
You touch my stuff, I'll kill you. I mean, that's what I think.
Touch my stuff, I'll kill you. You look at my stuff, I'll kill you.
Chill, buddy.
But, I feel like in a lot of this moment that we've been in for the last, let's call it the last decade, a lot of we listen in the country a lot more to our, we don't listen to our better angels anymore.
Well, the mask country, on, it's, I think. And when you got a mask on and you got a gun and your gun is drawn, your gun is out along with your camera. Yeah. You have a gun in hand. All you have to do is pull the trigger. But talk about having that kind of license. All you have to do is pull the trigger. I mean, it's insane.
And then you get the vice president saying he has absolute immunity.
The precedent here is very simple. You have a federal law enforcement official engaging in federal law enforcement action. That's a federal issue. That guy is protected by absolute immunity. He was doing his job.
Which, we have had a long history in this country of holding everybody to account, including people who work for the government. And saying somebody has absolute immunity, to my mind, is that's a little bit frightening to me. I don't know about you, but I found that phrase out of Vance's mouth rather disturbing.
Well, I think the president, we learned from Nixon's days, going back to Nixon, when you talk, Charlie Manson was guilty, but the president shouldn't say that.
Right.
You don't say Charlie Manson's guilty on television. Didn't that ruin that case? Didn't that upset that case?
It did affect the case, and what's his name in his book about Manson wrote about that. Like the defense attorneys knew they had a hook. Once the most powerful man in the world comes out and says something terrible about their client, no matter how terrible and guilty he was. So Chris, I want to ask in this list of lessons about the world, and I that combination of. I think we've missed this for a while. That combination of idealism and yet he was also a hard political player. He knew how to fight in both government and in politics. Do we have anybody on the scene that you're watching today that gets close to that ideal? God.
Well, it's probably not Krasner, the DA in Philly. Okay, I'll go with you. And Laurie out in San Francisco. He recognizes that the city has gotten completely out of control. And I have seen the defecating in the streets of San Francisco. You're driving and you see it in front of you. You go, excuse me, this is not the way a city should be run. Whatever you say about human rights, stop that. Stop that behavior. And so the homeless situation, the unhoused situation is the nice way of putting it. These are all realities.
Right.
And I think that, and you see a neighborhood, by the way, When you get a neighborhood down near Union Square, and you get a neighborhood where they're poor people living along the streets, those buildings are no longer places for commerce. Those businesses are dead.
Correct.
They're all killed. So you're basically, as my daughter says, you know, homeless people don't walk uphill. So get an apartment on the hill, because people are not, it's just, there's a sadness. It was that they're all down there crowding around these streets, drugged up. And you go, are you going to do something about this or not? And the liberals, in the worst case, would say no. They have as much right to their space in our community as anybody. Okay, that's very, very literally fun and probably literally true. But you got to deal with the situation. And he is trying to fix it up. And apparently you still drive in there at night through the Tenderloin and you see what you see, you know. But I think he's trying to do it. And I think he's going to save the city. He saved him from National Guard people being sent in there. Apparently somebody spoke for him. Bobby Kennedy had this belief that he was, as you suggested, he was part Irish cop and part liberal. And he was a cop when he went after the bad guys in the gangster world. And after Big Steel, in fact, too. He was pretty tough with Big Steel.
Mm-hmm.
But he had sympathy for people who had it rough in life, whether it be Hispanic people.
Mm-hmm.
Working on the farms in California or South African blacks. So he understood the problem of being poor and not being on the right side of the law when you're born that way. But he made a point of telling people, okay, you're right. When Martin Luther King was killed, he walked into a tough neighborhood in Indianapolis. It's called the Brooklyn neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the police wouldn't go with him. He didn't have any shotgun guard coming in with him. He went in there alone. In fact, I got on the tape. I found an NBC tape where he asked the guy who was his host. He said, do the people know yet that Martin Luther King was killed this afternoon? And the guy said, no, they don't know it. This is before cell phones, obviously. And people didn't get everything until they got to the nightly news. So he had to tell them. First thing he had today is Martin Luther King was killed today by a white guy. And then he said, my brother was killed by a white guy, which always seemed like a strange thing to say, because Jack Kennedy wasn't killed by a white guy because he was white. He was killed by a white guy who just happened to be white. But the point is, by Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
But he was trying to find some basis of suffering that he shared with the people in that crowd. And I understand, when I think about it, that's what he was trying to do. So, you know, when he campaigned in Indianapolis, later in Gary, Indiana, in that same Indiana primary, he would ride around the car with Richard Hatcher, the first African-American mayor of that city. It was a real working-class town, Steel City. And mm-hmm. Tony Zale, the middleweight champ, who had not so much played that big in the movie, upstairs likes me in the Rocky Graziano movie. But he did knock out Rocky Graziano twice.
Right.
he's quite the middleweight champ. And he had him on the other side, a white guy and a black guy, a hero to white working people on one side, a hero to African-American voters on the other side. And he was trying to say, in an open car, he was trying to say, hey, I'm with both groups. I'm trying to be honest. I'm trying to be fair. And, you know, when people have written about him, they pointed out that he thought cops and waitresses and the regular people you bump into as his people. They're the ones he was rooting for. He said, you know, the mm-hmm. waitress would be, got him a cup of coffee or something. He said, she's one of us. I'm one of them. And even though he was born to wealth, he, at the end, he was killed, having spent his life with diplomats and aristocrats and people like that. He was reaching for the hand of a Mexican-American dishwasher when he was shot. And I think he really was trying to be one of the people that they was rooting for, and at his best, that's who Bobby Kennedy was.
Amazing. Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it. Folks, this is a great book, Lessons from Bobby, 10 Reasons Robert F. Kennedy Still Matters. It'll open you up to his character and his history and to a complicated man who the counterfactual, what he would have been like as president, we'll never know. But it's a great chronicling of the things that worked that he did. Some of them aren't tales of glory and greatness. Some of them are tales of a guy who understands the world and lives in it as a real person. So, Chris, thank you again, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, Greg, it's great to everyone. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.